In this second hour of Midday, we continue our conversation on the racist killings in Charleston. The alleged shooter's motivations appear clear based on what he said and on a manifesto he published online. However, some have raised questions about 21-year-old Dylan Roof's mental state. Dr. Gordon Livingston talks about violent behavior and the ability of mental health professionals to predict and prevent it. And we turn to news in Baltimore, with Police Commissioner Anthony Batt saying that reform comes with a cost, and that raising standards in the city will likely result in more police officers being forced out of the department. We'll also hear about efforts to match nearly 8,000 Baltimore kids with summer jobs. That's Midday, our second hour after the news. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here again. Thanks for Monday's lunch to Rosina Gourmet. Rosina Gourmet, since 1999, has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. They're located in Canton, downtown Baltimore and Harbor East. Catering available by visiting rosinagourmet.com, R-O-S-I-N-A-gourmet.com. We'll continue our conversation in this hour about the shooting deaths in Charleston for a bit. Later in the hour, we'll hear from a young man who got his start in the world of finance and banking thanks to Baltimore's YouthWorks. The YouthWorks program has expanded dramatically this year in the wake of April's unrest and aims to place nearly 8,000 city youth with summer jobs. We'll hear about that during this hour of the show. And we'll speak with Amy Dillard, J. Amy Dillard, a law professor at the University of Baltimore who has served on ad hoc committees reviewing police conduct. We're going to be speaking with her about police reform in Baltimore. And Friday's, or the weekend's, op-ed in the Baltimore Sun by Police Commissioner Anthony Batts. We'll be talking with Amy Dillard about that in a few minutes. Up first, though, we continue our conversation on the mass shooting in Charleston that left 9 dead. The shooting is believed to have been racially motivated. The gunman, Dylan Roof, posted a manifesto online that reads in part, I'll just quote a part of it here, "I chose Charleston because it is most historic city in my state and at one time had the highest ratio of blacks to whites in the country. We have no skinheads, no real KKK, no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world, and I guess that has to be me." Others have speculated about Roof's mental health, wondering what could have led him to commit such a violent crime. We welcome back to Midday Dr. Gordon Livingston, a Columbia-based psychiatrist and author of several books who's been on our show before. And unfortunately, it seems like each time we've spoken to Dr. Livingston, except about his books, it has been about mass killings, about violent behavior. Gordon Livingston, welcome back to the Midday Show.
Nice to be here, Dan.
It does seem like that's when you and I speak on the air, doesn't it? I think the last time was, well, I don't know, Newtown, or was it Aurora? I can't remember. There have been so many of these now.
Yeah, and there's a certain repetition to them. And the commonalities, I think, ought to be looked at. Obviously, there's a very different diagnoses between the people who perpetrate these crimes. From the Aurora shooter, for example, is quite evidently psychotic, to the latest example in South Carolina, for which we don't really have any clear idea in terms of his mental health. But they do share something by and large. They're all alienated loners. There are people who, for one reason or another, have developed a rage at society or some part of the society for their exclusion. And that was particularly true, for example, with the Newtown shooter. But there's another aspect of this that your guests have very correctly pointed out, that that racism and the proliferation of guns both bear a strong responsibility for this. But I think we ought to give some attention to the whole subject of fear we don't have a very good sense of ourselves when it comes to fear. We congratulate ourselves on being the home of the brave, but in our national anthem, but I don't think we act that way. We act like very fearful people. Carrying a concealed weapon, in my opinion, is an act of cowardice. It's a statement that one is so frightened of moving about in the world unarmed that you have to carry a gun with you. And I think that a lot of what drives the NRA in its successful opposition to any sort of gun control is this larger issue of inducing fear in the population. And so when, for example, the 9/11 attacks took place, there was a big increase in the sale of guns. That somehow we were going to protect ourselves against hijacked airplanes by buying a handgun. So it's completely irrational, but it's a very strong theme in the society.
There was also an increase in gun sales after President Obama's election out of fear that President Obama was going to be able to enact more rigorous gun control, take away assault rifles, assault-style weapons from Americans. That's there, too. But, you know, prejudice and fear kind of go hand in hand a bit, don't they? People are...
Yeah, absolutely. Racism is a form of fear. It serves as a target for people who feel excluded from the society at large, and they identify the source of that exclusion with a group that's somehow different than themselves. So that's quite true that the fear, of course, there's a very close relationship between fear and anger. And so once people have identified fully with one of these white supremacy philosophies, then suddenly everything is clear to them. What's happening is not their fault. It's the fault of some other group who must, if possible, be eliminated.
Gordon Livingston, I want you to unravel this for me then a little bit, given what you just said. So we have, you know, based on press reports, that's all we have so far. We don't have a full evaluation of this alleged shooter, Dylan Roof. But we have a racist manifesto. We have other evidence, photographs, and comments from friends and whatnot to suggest that this was an act of racial hatred, violent racial hatred. So how do you unravel that from those who think, well, somebody who goes into a church and sits for an hour with people of faith and then pulls out a gun and systematically kills 9 of them, reloads the weapon, 4 or 5 times? There's got to be something mentally wrong with that person. You see what I mean? Some people would say, no, he's just a racist, a violent racist. Others will say, well, no, there's got to be something really wrong there.
Well, maybe so, but diagnostically it's pretty hard to put your finger on. I mean, the people who, starting with the Columbine shooters, people who engage in this kind of behavior seem to want to dignify it, as, for example, the Unabomber did, with some sort of rationalization that makes it seem like more than it is. It's not just that they hate black people or that they have anger at a specific group. There's also some, and one has no trouble on the internet finding on right wing websites, there's no trouble in finding rationalizations. Now, this one, seeing the one that Roof put out seems particularly half-baked and just a sort of a compilation of things that he's read here and there. So these tend not to be, they tend to serve as a kind of rationale or justification for what really is simply a sense of alienation and hatred.
Here's another question for you. Back in April, when we had the riots here in Baltimore, famously a video of a mother trying to pull her son, actually slapping her son, her teenage son, to try to get him out of this behavior on April 27th so that he would not be involved in the riot, mm-hmm. a video that went viral. Where other people said, well, where are the parents? Meaning, where are the parents of the young men who were involved in these in the destruction and fires that occurred on April 27th? So I have a similar question when it comes to a young man like this, the alleged shooter in this case, and in these other cases of young white men. And I wonder, where are the parents? Do they not understand that they have a troubled son, that that there's problems here, and that this person, this son of theirs, probably should not be near weapons? I do have that question.
And of course, the problem is that there are so many troubled sons in the country, very few of whom turn to violence as a solution to the problems, that we all wish that people grew up in loving households in which their needs were for affection were met, and in which they were able to incorporate a decent sense of values. But the fact is, a lot, and when I say a lot, I mean millions of people don't. And out of that large number of people, there are going to be some who are so angry and so disturbed and feel so ignored by the larger society that they are going to do something dramatic, like go out and shoot other people. But it's pretty hard to identify ahead of time, and it's also therefore kind of hard to blame the parents for being inattentive.
Well, I don't mean to blame parents in a blanket way, but I do wonder about, in the case, if the press reports are true, that this young man at the age of 21 got a gun, either was given money by his parents and purchased a gun, or the parents gave him the gun as a present. It's hard to believe that in the year that he turned 21, all of this happened to him, that his ideas about black Americans and white supremacy all just sort of gelled in the last few days. It's hard to believe that there wasn't some awareness of it.
But this is South Carolina. Don't you imagine there are a lot of guns being exchanged as presents? I mean, that's a part of the, that's a part of the culture down there. So the fact that this one very angry kid would use it in the way that he did, I think just speaks to the larger cultural problem which your previous guests have spoken to, which is that we're awash in guns, 320 million of them. And so if that's the culture you're in, it's virtually an entitlement to own a gun or several guns.
I'll give you that with regards to the state of South Carolina, but there's also the state of denial, which you and I have talked about on this show before, Dr. Livingston.
Yeah, state of denial, of course. No one wants to believe that our child is going to go out and commit a murder, and I think that, we'll get more information about his family background, and we'll assume that that it was dysfunctional, and that he didn't receive any sort of an ideal upbringing. But I think it's too easy to get sidetracked on that, and that's what the NRA depends on. Well, what we've got here is really, it's not guns, it's a mental health issue. I think that's a, I think, so I think in that sense, it's a distraction.
And it could be both, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You have to assume that this kid has some problems, but whether or not they fit into any discernible diagnostic category other than hatred is just unknown.
Thank you very much, Dr. Livingston. It's a pleasure to get you on the show again.
Thank you, Dan.
Good
to be here.
Yep, thank you very much. Gordon Livingston, who is a psychiatrist based in Columbia. Look him up. He's got several interesting books. He's been on our show before to talk about them and about mental health. This is the Midday Show. We have to take a short break here in our second hour. When we return, we'll catch up on some recent news in Baltimore. We'll hear about the city's goal of placing nearly 8,000 young adults in summer jobs. Plus, we'll speak with J. Amy Dillard, law professor at the University of Baltimore, about police reform efforts. In an op-ed for the Baltimore Sun over the weekend, Police Commissioner Anthony Batts wrote that reform efforts will likely be accompanied by more arrests or dismissals of officers. We'll talk with Amy Dillard when we get back. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. 410-662-8780 is our phone number for further comment from our listeners. If you want to call in or send me an email that I'll read on the air, midday@wypr.org. Before we speak with Professor Dillard, Amy Dillard at UB Baltimore, let's talk to John in Baltimore, get his comments in on the air here. Hi, John. Go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I wanted to express a frustration that I have heard very little over the last 4 days of our political figures or any other figures willing to concede responsibility on a national level for what happened in South Carolina. I heard Marco Rubio say the flag issue wasn't his to comment on. Rick Santorum said the same thing. Even our president, of whom I'm a great admirer, seems reluctant to identify that the political culture we've created, with many of our political leaders, especially Republicans, using language such as taking back our country, that promotes the notion that this young man in South Carolina seems to have been operating on, which is there is something to take our country back from, some alien presence or some un-American feature of our society that we've got to wrest our country back from. I think there's a lot of responsibility to go around, and I don't hear anybody actually saying that there's responsibility to go around.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear the president's comments this morning?
I haven't heard the president this morning. I think the most recent was over the weekend about aspects of gun control and his concern, obviously, for the fact that there's no political movement around gun control, not even after Newtown.
Well, John, you ought to catch up today with the president's interview via podcast, his remarks about racism in America, which we discussed in the earlier hour of the show, but it's well worth checking out.
I will happily do that. Thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah, sure. U.S. is not cured of racism, President Obama says, citing slavery's legacy. This was Mark Moran's WTF podcast. Did I say Marin or Moran? It's M-A-R-O-N, right? That's the fellow associated with Louis C.K., right? He does his podcast in a garage. Yeah, okay. The legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, discrimination in almost every institution of our lives, that casts a long shadow, and that's still part of our DNA that's passed on, among the remarks the president made in that interview with Mark Maron. David, right along these same lines, before we go to Amy Dillard. David, go right ahead with your comments.
Actually, it follows pretty well from John's comment.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of inaccurate to characterize this gunman as a loner because it's obviously symptomatic, first of all, of, some sort of other social undercurrents with, the idea of taking back the country. And it's also a little unfair in the way that white gunmen are characterized as loners. It's kind of a sort of apologism in which they're not, they're thought of as something, for which society is unaccountable or can't be accountable, whereas, young black men who engage in violence are kind of characterized as mainstream, like, it's a problem with the culture, where are the parents? Whereas,
mm-hmm.
An excuse is sort of made when the gunman is white.
Yeah, That's sort of why I asked that question, where are the parents? Because I don't hear that asked that much when we see these mass shootings, David. So I'm kind of right there with you. Thank you very much for your comments. The Baltimore Sun published an op-ed by Police Commissioner Anthony Batts of Baltimore. It was online Friday. It appeared in print in the Sunday paper. Commissioner Batts wrote about what the department has accomplished in his time here. He's been here 3 years now. New cars, a pay raise for officers, the dismissal of 72 officers for disciplinary reasons, citing the towing scandal. You remember that. And he wrote about how much further the department has to go. Specifically, he questioned the attitudes of officers who, quote, treat the public with callous disregard, and stated that officers with, quote, outdated views of policing should expect to be forced out as the police department enacts these reforms. We asked J. Amy Dillard to join us again, associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Amy Dillard is an expert in criminal defense. She also sat on the review panel for the Baltimore City Police Department's probe into the death of Tyrone West in police custody in 2013. And she was a member of a police practices review commission in Fairfax County, Virginia. So I thought she'd get her on the show to comment about the police commissioner taking this approach, an op-ed in The Sun, and what he had to say. Amy, thank you very much for joining us again.
Happy to be here, Dan.
Yeah, what did you, first of all, think of the approach of the publishing an op-ed on this subject and what the commissioner had to say?
Well, there's sort of no doubt that the parties here have gone to their corners, whether it's the police union representing rank-and-file officers and the commissioner, or the mayor and the police union, or the mayor maybe even, and the police commissioner, as best I can tell. I thought it was a very aggressive op-ed. I think that, you know, laying out at the very beginning that more officers are likely to be arrested could speak to a vacuum in the leadership position, meaning if you have to wait until they've harmed someone such that they can be arrested, then you've waited too long to do something about it. Now, you know, I understand the tricky position that he's in, right? I mean, he may have allegations against some officers that don't rise to the level of termination for them from their employment. And so there are those issues that he has to deal with. And maybe he's talking about long-term investigations that are going on against Baltimore police officers, and he's simply saying, we know there are more indictments coming. You know, he specifically cites greed and corruption as the things that he hopes to replace with professionalism and integrity. And so it may be that there are long-term investigations that are going on. But if he's talking about more officers who acted the way the officers acted when they arrested Freddie Gray, then that seems to me waiting too long.
Yep. I agree with you there. You know, it's interesting, Amy Dillard, the Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake and the police commissioner both have a hard time getting the public to understand, appreciate any reforms that they brought to bear before Freddie Gray, because Freddie Gray, the death of Freddie Gray looms so large over the city now, and of course the arrest of six officers in connection with his death. So any talk about reforms that were enacted before that happened, progress that was made, even reductions in violent crime that were made during that time, it seems to all be obscured by this event, the death of Freddie Gray.
Well, I think it helps, too, though, to think that, you know, as I mentioned, you got a police union, a mayor, and a commissioner, but another piece in this conversation, and arguably the biggest piece, is the public, right? I mean, all these other parties are there because of the public. And, you know, it's easy to think of the public as falling into two categories, those who want less crime and those who are most likely to be hassled or killed by police officers. But I actually don't think those are two distinct groups, certainly not in Baltimore, given the very large minority population. You know, you can't see that you've got one group of people that you're trying to help by harming another group of people, because I don't think those communities are distinct. I also just, look, reform takes time. Reform that's long-term, as most people argue that it is in Baltimore, takes a long time. But putting operations in place to make actual change, whether that comes in training and education and practice for officers, I just think that has to be a priority. You know, a lot has been said about Commissioner Batts' salary and the fact that new cars were bought for officers, even though when they went out in the midst of the Freddie Gray, I'll use my air quotes, riots, that they didn't have proper protective gear. You know, those choices, those sort of administrative choices, I can almost take those and push them aside, because what we're really, really talking about here is not something that's going to get fixed by giving another piece of equipment to an officer. We're really talking about on-the-ground training. How do you respond in this situation that you might see 5, 6, 7 times a day?
There's something else I want to talk to you about, because it takes a moment of reflection, the extraordinary situation that we're in here. I mean, I do think it is extraordinary. 6 police officers arrested in connection with the death of a man, a 25-year-old man, in their custody. Now, go back to the Rodney King case in the early 90s, and you had 4 police officers actually on trial. Here we have 6 in Baltimore City. This is, I wouldn't say unprecedented for a police officer to be on trial, but certainly 6 in this situation. And all the public interest in it, the swirling, this tumult of public interest in what's happened here, and outrage and anger over it, followed by violence and a surge in violent crime and homicides in the city and a decline in arrests and statements from the police union suggesting that police officers are, quote unquote, afraid to do their jobs because they might be charged by the state's attorney. This is an extraordinary circumstance that we find ourselves in here. And a lot of people are asking this question of the police. Do you mean to tell me you're not going to do your jobs because some of your colleagues were charged with a crime?
Yeah.
We need to reflect on this a minute, Amy, because it's an unusual situation, I think, nationally.
I completely agree. You know, the number of officers that are prosecuted when suspects die in custody is very, very small. So that alone makes this case unique. Add to it that it's 6 officers charged in varying degrees, depending on the contact that they allegedly had with Freddie Gray. But 6 officers are, at this point, by the state's attorney, being held responsible in that they have to answer for the death. And it's easy to see, I would think, if you're a rank-and-file police officer, that those prosecutions are symbolic. And that, if you're a rank-and-file police officer, you wonder if you might likewise be prosecuted on symbolic grounds for, a politician who's trying to accomplish reform but who's also a politician. I get the unrest that comes from the police union. It makes sense to me, given that, probably the vast majority of officers have never been involved in this kind of an arrest, I like to hope, at least. But I am left, thinking about what it takes to change and cause an effect. It's easy to say, well, you've prosecuted, Mosby, you've decided to indict and prosecute 6 officers, and there's been a steep decline in Sandtown in particular of arrests between April and May, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to say, well, those officers who are assigned to that district just, showing up to work but not doing a whole lot. Or maybe they've been told and trained that they need a little more than a person running when they ride their bicycle down the street. And if they have been told that they need a little more evidence before they detain someone who they see look at them and run when they're riding the bicycle down the street, that might be a reform that, the community can get behind, right? That's what I suppose lots of people wish had happened with Freddie Gray.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's hard to know. It's hard to,
know what
the cause and effect here is. But, you know, if you have to also think about what were those arrests for, and I don't know. I actually looked as I, before I got on here with you to try to find out. But, you know, if the 63 arrests in April, if most of them were, you know, Freddie Gray-type arrests, meaning officers are riding or walking through a neighborhood and see somebody who catches their eye and that person then runs from them and they arrest that person and they find a knife that they maybe charge them with or residue of some sort of drug or you know, something that they can charge them with. Are those the kinds of arrests that, you know, make a community safer? Those are the kinds of arrests that, you know, good law-abiding citizens want being made in their community? Or does that mean that more people are being caught up in this web of let's just stop people and see if we can find them doing something wrong?
Right.
And I think that is, you know, I often say that police, when I teach this, I tell my class that police officers have transitioned over their role, I think, has really transitioned over the course of the last century or last half century from what we think of as protection and prevention of crime, you know, very Andy Griffith style, protection and prevention,
right,
to a place where they are investigating and really serving prosecution purposes. I mean, some of that's just, you know, the war on drugs, which means that, you know, they're investigating what they see as signs of criminal activity, one of which could be someone running away from them after that person notices police officers seeing them. But then in the arrest and in the search of that person, the police are looking for evidence to hand over to the prosecution so that there can be a successful prosecution of someone like Freddie Gray. And I don't think that Freddie Gray is an anomaly. I mean, from my experience as a public defender, you know, most of my clients who were arrested and charged with everything from trespassing to drug crimes, their arrest looked a lot like Freddie Gray's. It's on the street. It's without a warrant. It's with the officers either maintaining that they had probable cause to arrest or reasonable suspicion, as they maintain with Freddie Gray. And it really is, you know, what my clients used to call sort of a freebie pat-down, and the cops hope they find something, and they hand that over to the prosecutor, who then prosecutes that case, hopefully successfully, if you're a prosecutor and a police officer. But, you know, that style of policing is something that, you know, has become the norm, I think, in big urban communities where drugs have become the primary focus of police departments.
Yeah, it's interesting. I appreciate your thoughts, Amy, that there's an assumption even in my question or in, with anyone who looks at the decline in arrests and the increase in violence, that we sort of automatically make a correlation or even a cause and effect. And it's you can't. You don't know.
You don't know. And, you know, it's easy to sort of go another step or triangulate away from that and say, well, if you arrest fewer Freddie Grays, that is, you know, people who the police think may be involved in drug trafficking in some way on a street level, if you arrest fewer of those people, then those people remain in your community, and those people also bring violence and other crimes to your community. I mean, right, that's the rhetoric that justified the war on drugs in the first place, right? It's the secondary crime that actually destroys cities as much as the primary crime of distributing drugs and destroying individual lives and families.
J. Amy Dillard, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Thank you very much for being with us again, Amy.
Happy to, Dan.
Another quick break here on Midday, folks. When we come back, the mayor of Baltimore, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake's stated goal is to place nearly 8,000 youth in Baltimore summer jobs. How close are they to meeting that goal? We'll hear how YouthWorks provides teens and young adults with job opportunities, and we'll meet a banker who got his start with the program. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. One of the notable aspects of the April riot was the large number of young people involved. That's been widely noted. Young people People voice concerns about their educations, about recreation in the city, about finding jobs. We heard a lot about that. This summer, Baltimore plans to make headway on one of those fronts by expanding YouthWorks, the YouthWorks program. YouthWorks matches young adults between the ages of 14 and 21 with five-week summer work experiences, primarily with nonprofits and businesses in Baltimore and the state. YouthWorks also has a private sector program called Hire One Youth that prepares young adults for future full-time positions. Last week, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan designated a little over $3 million to help Baltimore match youth with summer jobs. So there's some funding coming in for this, but the issue is getting jobs. Bryce Freeman is with us. Bryce is Communications Director for the Mayor's Office of Employment Development. Nice to have you with us, Bryce.
Great to be here, Dan.
So how are my numbers there? Am I correct? YouthWorks is for young men, young women between 14 and 21.
Yep.
And they get a five-week work experience. And YouthWorks has been around for a few years, right?
A long time. You know, Baltimore City should be really proud of their summer jobs program. It hasn't been called YouthWorks for more than 30 years, but we've been doing it that long. It's one of the best in the nation. And I want to point out there was a time when federal funds supported summer jobs. There was standalone funding all up until the year 2000. And then after that, what happened in a lot of jurisdictions, they either scaled back or cut back or cut it completely, but not in Baltimore. We've continued to offer more than 5,000 young people a summer job experience every year.
And how many job sites do 5,000 kids go to? I'm going to call them kids, even though if you're 21,
yeah.
To me, if you're 21, you're still a kid. But
right.
Anyway.
Well, more than 400. This year, we're looking at more than 500 because we're upping the numbers.
Okay, so that's what we wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So if the number goes to 8,000, that's the mayor's stated goal, right?
Yeah.
Does the 3.3 million that came in from the state, does that help toward, I assume that helps toward that?
Oh, absolutely helps. I mean, we have funding from a lot of different sources, and the city is putting in $1.7 million. The state last year put in $2.3 million, $1.3 million from the governor's office, and then $1 million from the Department of Human Resources that is specifically for children of families that receive temporary cash assistance or foster kids. So that's the other $1 million. And then the governor announced an additional $1 million to make it to $3.3
million. Okay, and just so we understand, where does that money go?
Well, it costs about $1,500 per slot. And over $1,000 of that is actually in strict salary for the young people.
Okay. Give me an example of a job, of one of those, would you say, 500 work sites?
Yeah. Well, it ranges so much. We talk about, like, are they kids, right, 14 to 21. Let's take a look at our lives. How were we different when we were 14 as compared to when we were 21, the types of jobs we've had? So for the younger, 14 to 15, maybe their first job, it's more likely to be in a community center, maybe a church, a city agency, something like that. As the young people get older, more seasoned, more familiar with what their career goals are, we place them in places like Wells Fargo or an architectural firm or Veolia Energy or higher level jobs that require higher skills. So it really ranges. It can be really soup to nuts.
Rashad Dubose is with us. Rashad, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
How old are you?
I am 20 at the turn.
Okay, I'm not going to call you a kid, though.
Nice
to have you. And so, Rashad, you actually went through this other program I mentioned. Well, it's part of YouthWorks, Hire One Youth program.
Yes, sir.
So tell us about that. When did you get started with that?
Okay, Hire One Youth, I actually started in July of 2013. That's when they initially had me come in for initial training. It was job readiness training. For which they kind of sat a couple of the youth down. It actually started around the age of 18 and up. That's who they were working with.
Were you still in high school?
Actually, I graduated by then.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they sat us down. They talked about how to come to interviews, how to be job ready, how the resume should look. It was a day's program where they kind of prepared us for the workforce.
So you took a job. What was your first job? Wells Fargo. So Bryce mm-hmm. mentioned Wells Fargo. Is
yep.
that where you took a job?
That's where I first started. I started as a teller at the St. Paul location, part-time. That's what Hire One set me up with.
Okay. And were you going to college?
At the same time, yes.
Where did you go to college?
University of Baltimore.
Oh, okay. So you're going to college and you have this job. Now, was this job just for the summer or was this is more than just a summer job?
This is actually a regular employment through Wells Fargo.
Okay, and what has that turned into for you?
Well, I started as a part-time teller. Now I'm a banker full-time. So in the past 2 years, it's done me a great deal of service. Even the beginning portion, they would kind of do a check-in with us, you know, just to seeing how the job's working. I know for me regularly, maybe every month I would have a representative from the Hire One program just come by, see how things going, see how the job's working out, just to make sure things are consistent and working best for us. So I've had a lot of support. And then as time's gone on, my career with Wells Fargo has really, really developed. It has been very profitable for me. In the last year, I have gotten a promotion to where I am a banker now in full time. So
and you look the part. You're wearing a superb suit, ladies and gentlemen. Rashad looks great, and he's got a power tie on, too. So why do you think you needed this help?
I think it was very beneficial to me because what they strive to do is try to make sure everyone gets a place, a position. Because I originally did the Youth Works application, I believe it was in February, where they do the initial sign-up and things of that nature. So I think it was good for me because me being a youth applying to a bank, you know, just coming out of high school, you know, I just kind of know the basics. It's kind of like I have experience and knowledge and stuff, but what's really going to set me apart, what's really going to get me out there? The Hire One Youth Program is that step to where, okay, now I am the youth, I have the experience. Now I'm set up with them, they've given me training, they've put me where I need to be, and they're going to set me up for that interview so I can initially get into the door and represent myself.
I get that. So it helps, Bryce, it helps with the employer to know Rashad and others went through this program, right? And the program stands behind them.
Exactly. Hire One Youth is a private sector component of Youth Works. In 2012, the mayor identified the fact that, hey, look, a lot of businesses were supporting Youth Works, but they'd be more likely to write a check than actually provide the experience of hiring, interviewing, hiring.
You mean make a donation.
Write a check, right. A donation to help pay for something. But the mayor said, look, we really need the businesses to start training your future workforce. You know, by the year 2020, half the U.S. workforce will be the millennial generation. So businesses along, so leaders joined with the mayor, Don Fry, Greater Baltimore Committee is still the chair of Hire One Youth. They came together to say, hey, look, it's a wise business decision that we start interviewing and training the younger people now so that they can be part of our viable workforce now and in the future.
Rashad, were you going to go to college whether you had this job or not, or did this job
Absolutely.
Help? Okay, so you were going to go to college. Where'd you go to high school?
Poly, Baltimore Politics Institute.
All right, so I assume this job is helping you pay for college.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
So, and by the way, Youth Works, back to Youth Works for a moment, kids, I call them kids, who participate in that five-week program, they are paid a set amount?
Yes, they're paid at least minimum wage. The Hire One Youth businesses that actually interview and hire are just asked to say, you have to do the minimum. You can pay them more than higher on the minimum wage if you want to. You can do it more than 25 hours per week if you want. You can vary the hours because we want this to be a real job experience. But you're right. The young people will earn at least minimum wage, which is $8.25 an hour.
So, Rashad, you think Hire One Youth gave you a step up because otherwise you would have been just another 18-year-old out there, you know, submitting resumes online someplace?
Well, it definitely gave me further credentialing, I could say, because, you know, when you're applying for jobs, you're applying against all others. You know, you have it's you, it's the other guy, it's another girl. So and they're trying to pick the right person. Me having that experience through the Hire One, me being with the company that is, credentialed Youth Works, they've helped a lot of youth. So having that Hire One help me. It definitely was, it got me in the door. It definitely got me in the door versus not saying I couldn't have made it myself, but them being there definitely helped me a whole lot.
So you're with Wells Fargo, and is it a full-time job?
Yes.
Full-time, and you're going to UB?
Well, at the current moment, I'm actually attending school online. Actually, I'm not with University of Baltimore. I transferred out because of the full-time position, so I go to school online.
Oh, okay. How do you like banking?
It is definitely a field that I'm interested in. It's definitely going to help me as far as get a good understanding around the business portion, how money flows and where money goes
finance.
And how it works. Yeah, finance.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely like it.
Do you have an idea what part of it you like the most that you'd be interested in?
More so the business perspective of it, how businesses work in relation to finance.
Well, good for you. It says here also that you're in the Navy Reserves, is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
How does he do it, ladies and gentlemen? How does he do it? That's a lot, Rashad. Well, good luck to you. Now, I want to go back to Bryce Freeman here because 8,000 is a big number, and it's a big jump from 5,000.
It sure is.
So there's funding for 8,000.
We're almost there.
Almost there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If I could put why 8,000, you might say. Well, we a couple of years ago, we started the Youth Works registration process online. So at that point, our numbers of youth that were registering had an uptick. So 8,000 young people actually not only checked off a box and applied online, they had to attend a certification appointment to become fully registered, bringing documentation, et cetera. So we had 8,000 in the pool at the end of March. We traditionally have funding for 5,000. The unrest happened, a lot of attention. People said, how can we help? Well, we all recognize one of the issues was that we need more opportunities for young people. That's what we're talking about. So it made sense. Well, let's build upon a program that's already working. We have 3,000 in the queue that have already proven that they want to work. They've already proved some motivation. So let's get together and create 3,000 more work sites, get funding for them. We're almost there. We're making great progress. I think as of Friday, we're about 1,000 jobs short.
So there are 8,000 kids interested.
There are 8,000 not only interested, they registered. They registered completely. So they were, at the end of March, they knew that, hey, look, I might get a summer job. We knew that we'd be able to do at least 5,000. Now we're almost there to do 8,000 because, you know, we want to close that gap.
How far off are you? And, the date, important date here is July 13th, is that right?
That's a very important date. The first cycle for the 5 weeks starts next Monday, June 29th. But because of the increase, we wanted to buy ourselves some time, so we established a second five-week cycle that starts July 13th. That's where the other 3,000 will start to work if we get to that point. We're about, as I said, Friday, we're about 1,000 shy of the job sites, so we're still looking for good work sites. The funding, I'm told—
What can it be? If someone's listening right now and hasn't been involved with YouthWorks, and they have, a small business or a nonprofit—
Small business, nonprofit.
Like what kind of job? What are you looking for?
Well, and it could be anything that
paint
would help
the exterior walls.
It could be painting. It could be clerical. It could be IT. It could be a lot of young people. You know, help the small businesses because they've grown up more with computers and technology, and they can help them out with social media, for instance. But yes, it can be cleaning. It can be painting. It can be refurbishing. It can be pretty much anything. But the first step would be that the company or organization would go online, fill out a real quick application so we know what it is they're looking for.
And how do they do that?
They go to www.oedworks.com.
That's OED, that's the Office of Employment Development
Works with an S.com.
OEDworks.com?
Exactly. And then they'll just click, they'll see the YouthWorks logo, they go right there, and then they'll find out everything they need to know.
Okay, and there's still time, obviously, but what happens if you don't get enough by July 13th? You'll have some kids that just won't be able to take advantage of this, even though there'd be funding for it.
Yeah, that would be the case, and we really don't want that to happen. We really want to be able to offer every one of those 8,000 young people a summer job opportunity. And we're working with lots of different partners. The school system, for instance, is coming on board and trying to create a lot of new innovative-type work site experiences at individual schools around the city. That experience might be more heavy on the education piece but have a work component. But again, yes, that's the goal. We want to get there to so we offer all 8,000.
Rashad, this is good if you're 14 years old because it gets you in the habit of showing up each day, right?
Oh, yeah.
At least for 5 weeks.
Yep, at least for 5 weeks. You're doing what you need to do.
I'm trying to remember my first summer job. First time you had to, of course, you had to show up in time for school, but that was different when you had to actually show up and punch a clock. I remember my first summer job. I don't want to repeat it on the air what it was.
Did you learn from it, though?
Sure, I learned you got to show up on time, right? And and make sure you pack a lunch. Well, thank you very much, Bryce Freeman. So we'll pass along that information again. That's OED Works for Office of Employment Development with Baltimore City, but it's .com, OEDworks.com. If you're interested in hiring a young man, a young woman this summer. Because there's a need for about how many? 1,000 jobs?
As of Friday, we were shy about 1,000.
About 1,000.
But we're hoping to close that gap very quickly.
Bryce Freeman is a communications director for the Mayor's Office of Employment Development. And Rashad DuBose, we wish you luck in your career
thank
in finance. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having
you.
Me.
Bye-bye.